Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Mike Dugan, 40 years of combination experience with 27 of those being served with the FDNY, retired captain of Ladder 123. Mike started as a volunteer with Hail Site Fire Department in New York. Going career wasn't on his mind as Mike was making very good money as a heavy machinery rigger. It wasn't until a friend told him about career civil service that Mike then transitioned to being a police officer for a stint, then moved on to firefighting, which the rest of his career speaks for itself. I thoroughly enjoyed listening to Mike speak about his career and different viewpoints within the service. But the most important topic he spoke on is making sure we as firefighters have our own household in order before worrying about everything else with our careers. With that, I present Mike Dugan.
Hi, my name is Mike Dugan. I'm a retired captain from the FDNY, and I did 27 years in the FDNY. Prior to being a member of the FDNY, I was a volunteer firefighter in the Hail Site Volunteer Fire Department on the North Shore of Long Island. So how I got into the fire service is kind of a unique story. I was a young child, and my father, I was one of six kids growing up, and my father was very religious, a World War II veteran, a bomber pilot. And one Sunday morning, we always used to get up Sunday mornings and go to Mass, 7:45 Mass at St. Patrick's in Huntington. And it was always the first pew was the Burwood Home for the Blind, and the second pew and the third pew were my family's aunts, uncles, grandparents, the whole thing. We were there. We were just, it was just a thing that we did. And then we would go out afterwards and have either go to somebody's house or go out afterwards and have breakfast. So one Sunday morning, my father and I are up, and this is back in the days of the Catholic Church where you couldn't eat before you had communion. And we were cooking the bacon and getting ready, and we were going to go make a run to the local bakery to get, as my father called them, the goodies, the rolls for to go with breakfast, and the crumb buns and the jelly donuts and all that stuff. And the phone rang. And my parents' house, there were three phones in the house, one in the den, one on the kitchen wall, and one in my parents' bedroom. And that was it. And the phone rang at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was like 6:35. And I heard my father say, "Okay, all right, I'm on my way." And he looked at me and he said, "Your grandmother's house is on fire." And then I heard the local volunteer fire department, the whistle, the siren go off, and you could hear it. And he goes, "I got to go. Your grandma's house is on fire and they're trapped. I got to show the firemen where they are." And I looked at my dad and I said, "I'm coming with you." And he said, "No, you're not." And he said, I said, "I'm coming with you." And he goes, "No, you're not." And I said, "How are they going to know which driveway to go in?" Because at the time on Long Island, there were some rural roads. And at the end of the road where my grandparents' house was, there were three different driveways. First time I ever heard my father say a bad word. He said, "Shit, you're right. Get in the car." And I was about 10 years old, maybe 11. Got in the car. And he was in, it was a Buick station wagon with a metal dashboard and no seats, and we were on four wheels for probably about 35 to 40% of the ride. He got us there, threw me out at the end of the driveway. The first fire truck came, and I pointed down the driveway, and they went down the driveway. And the second fire truck came, I pointed down the driveway, and then I ran down the driveway, and I saw the local volunteer fire department rescue my grandmother and my Aunt Helen out of off a porch roof at a second floor doing VEIS. And I've always loved it since then. So the day I turned 18, I joined the local volunteer fire department. And then I was there. I was having a great time catching. We caught a lot of work back then. It was amazing. And I just happened to be around when most of it happened. I don't know why. They were checking my turnout gears for matches and gasoline. But we ended up having a lot of work. And then somebody told me, "You can get paid to do this." And very honestly, I was working in a career. I was moving heavy machinery and rigging and putting machinery together. They call it rigging it. and up into the, and I was doing rigging and mill writing. And I thought I was going to stay at that because I was doing very well. I was making money. And then the crap at the economy came in the 70s, the late 70s in New York City, where everything went to hell in a handbasket. So I started looking for something because I was paying for my own health insurance. I was paying for all the old stuff and I couldn't, I wasn't working much. So the police department called. I took the police department job and I was on the cops for a little while. And then the fire department called. And I went right to the fire department. Best decision I ever made.
Okay. Wow. That's a heck of a story. You don't hear very many people with a story like that of how
Yep.
they got into the fire service.
And the amazing part is, I never knew my father was a volunteer fireman. And he was a volunteer fireman before World War II in the local community. But when I joined, they said, "Are you going to be like your father?" One of the old timers. And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Your father was a turkey dinner fireman." And I said, "What's a turkey dinner fireman?" He goes, "He's the kind of guy who only shows up for free meals." And I said, "No, I'm going to have." And as soon as I crawled my first hallway, I was hooked. I mean, they had me hook, line, and sinker. I was hooked. As soon as I crawled my first hallway, it was like the greatest thing in the world.
Okay. All right. So you are second generation.
I am, but I wouldn't say my father was a fireman. He was only there for a couple of years before World War II. And then when he joined the military, I have a picture of my dad at not yet 22 years old as the captain of a B-26 bomber. At this point, this one was, he was a co-pilot on this one, but he became a pilot of a B-26 bomber and flew 65 missions over hostile territory. And he never went back to being a volunteer fireman after World War II.
Okay. All right. With that being said, somebody told you, hey, you could do this for a career, and you said that you went the NYP or the police department route, and then you found yourself at the fire department. What was it like going through? I'm assuming you had some sort of abbreviated academy or recruit class for the fire department.
Fire department, there is no abbreviated recruit class. Even if you're a volunteer, they don't care if you're a volunteer. You're learning the New York City way. Now, my academy, we had to go and get what they called, we called it, was peace officer training. We called it sleep officer training because they lectured us every Friday at the end of the week. They take us out and make us do our PT and then sit us in an auditorium for 6 hours of lectures on the laws and everything else. And if you fell asleep, you were punished. So we would have to stand up. If you were felt like you were falling asleep, you'd have to stand up and not fall asleep, because if they caught you, you would be out there running laps after everybody else went home or whatever else. But my academy, because of the extra, because of the peace officer training, which was required by law, they passed the law about it, went from 5 weeks to 6 weeks. So at the end of 6 weeks, we graduated and we were, out into the field.
Okay. And upon completion, what was your first assignment?
My assignment was one of the slower ladder companies in the city of New York, Ladder Company 137 in Rockaway Beach, Queens, on 116th Street. And back then, most of the guys in that firehouse were war year veterans, and they had done their 20, 25 years in busy companies in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, and they were now towards the end of their careers and they were slowing down. So the engine was 268 in the firehouse. And I always tell the story. One day I go into work and the engine's deal was the junior man got the nozzle. And there were in that company, it was only a four person engine company because they were slow. And the nozzle man, the one night I was working, had 29 years.
Wow.
Okay. And they were all in good places, great engine companies, 280, 234, 231 in Manhattan, 54 engine. They were all great, great firemen, but they had done their time. And so I was there and I was dying because I wanted to go to work and everything else. And I got appointed to the fire department in 1985. And I got married in May of 86. And I was on my honeymoon and I was transferred to Ladder Company 43 without even knowing where it was. And that's where I learned to be a fireman. The kicker was the captain of 43 truck, a guy by the name of Dan Marshall. He had been a lieutenant under the chief of department, John O'Rourke. And John O'Rourke said, I got this kid. And I finally found what I wanted to do, being a cop and being a fireman, being a civil service. So I graduated the police academy class as the valedictorian. And I graduated my fire academy class as the valedictorian. And so they said, we screwed up sending this kid to a slow company. We got to put him someplace. So they put me in 43 truck. And I always thank God and John O'Rourke for making this happen. And Captain Marshall and the guys in 43 truck taught me to be a fireman, taught me to do the job. And that's where I learned the job. And I was just surrounded by awesome, awesome firemen who were just amazing. I mean, if you wanted to know where to go at any fire, you looked at where these people went at a fire and what they did. There were people who were never out of position. They were always, and at every fire, after every fire, when I was a young fireman, especially when I was newer, we'd go back and we'd review every fire. Where did you go? What did you see? What? And the captain was just such a great teacher. Like we'd walk in the door of a building and he would look, and before we went out, okay, Michael, was there a fire escape on the front? How many mailboxes? Were there mailboxes on the left side or the right side or both sides? How many apartments per floor? How many doors to the apartment? And just, and you never wanted to fail. So you were always watching everything. And you always, and he taught me to look at everything. And it paid so many dividends in my career that it just helped me so many times. I mean, I remember one time going to a fire, and we were the second through truck. And we go in, and the fire's up on the third floor. And as we walk in the lobby, we go right to the stairs, but I stop and I look out the back real quick. We run up the stairs and we get up to the on the third floor and down the end of the hallway, way down the end of the hallway, about 120 feet down the hallway, is smoke and an open stairway door. And they're all running down there. I said, no, it's not there. And I said to the guys, it's over here somewhere. And everybody's looking. The first dude's down there looking, trying to find it. I go, it's one of these doors here. And I go around and I'm touching the doors. That's the one. Pop this door. We got the fire. So we get all done. And my guys go, how the hell did you know that? So, well, when we walked in the lobby, I could see this the glow in the snow in the backyard. And so I knew it was near here. And I went and I looked. And I looked at the building across and it pointed out the windows. It looked like it was one of these up here. So that smoke, that door must have been opened and just drawing the smoke down there, the natural flow path. And I said, and I knew it was one of these doors. So you just have to pay attention and look at everything. There were clues there. And you always, and that's how you do your job. You pay attention, you watch everything, you learn everything. My friends are still amazed. We'll be sitting out with my retired group having coffee, and a lot of them are not firemen. And all of a sudden, I'll say, oh, yeah, I saw you drive the other way yesterday. Where were you going? How'd you know that? I see everything. It's just the way I am. I see everything. And but you get good by doing that.
Yes. How important would you say it is for individuals coming into the fire service now to try to find those mentors that you had?
Oh, it's so important. It's vitally important. Find the person you want to be like, the mentor you want to be like. My captain changed my life. He was my work dad. And he taught me how to be a fireman. And I loved the man dearly. I still think about him often. And You have to find every man or woman in the fire service can be an example, some for the good, some for the bad. Find the people you want to be like, the people who do their jobs, not the people who are popular, not the people who are good at what they do, the people who are always in the right position, always have the right tools, always know what they're doing. And if they don't, they admit it and learn from it. They never make the same mistake twice. Those are the men and women you want to be a member of the fire service with, because they are the brothers and sisters who are going to protect you and make you better and get you better and make it better for you.
Sir, definitely. Okay. Earlier you mentioned back when your grandmother's house caught on fire, you mentioned the four letters VEIS, meaning even back then fire departments were doing that. Like VEIS is nothing new to the fire
Nothing new.
service.
Nothing new. They put up a portable ladder. I went up onto a porch roof, took out a window, and grabbed my grandmother and my aunt and brought them down the portable ladder. They did the right thing. They went in there, and if they had tried to go in the stairs, we later found out that the carpet in the living room, the floor had burnt out. The carpet was being held by like the tackless. And towards the end of the fire, the piano rolled down because there was no floor underneath it and went through the carpet. But if they had tried to walk them down the stairs, they would have died. So I think it's very, very important that you understand the game and the history. Nothing is new in the fire service. Okay. I mean, there are innovations all the time. Air packs getting lighter, the new wire frames. The wire frames that we used to have are coming back out on Scat Packs now. Brilliant. Brilliant. Okay, lighten up the pack. I mean, I'm all for it. But it's so important that you understand the history of the fire service. George Santayana said it, if you don't know history, you are doomed to repeat it. We have made mistakes in the fire service. We are the group that we name our mistakes. Hackensack Ford. You can go look at the book that Frank Lieb and Billy Goldfeder did, 30 Fires You Should Know. I was talking to somebody recently. I thought it was one of the best things I ever heard. The guy was an officer. He brought the book into the firehouse and he said, "Okay, here you go. On our next shift, you, Fireman A, you're going to report on this fire. You bring the book home, you're going to do a book report on this fire. What you learned reading about it. You can study more at home, you can do whatever you want, but you are going to look at this fire and study this fire. And we're going to talk about it. It's going to be our next drill. And you're going to bring up the drill. Take the book home. Bring it back. The next tour, firefighter B, you have this one. You have the next fire. I want you to study this fire." And I'm like, that's a brilliant, brilliant. Because 30 fires you should know, anything locally that happens in your jurisdiction that you should know, you should be sitting down at the firehouse at the table and talking about these things. One of the things we do not do anymore in the fire service is sit down and communicate with each other. I used to tell people after the meals, I would make the guys sit down for 10 or 15 minutes and talk. We have to talk to each other. Yeah, you do. You have to talk to each other about what's going on in your life.
Yes, sir. Definitely.
Yeah, and
It's
it's so important.
something that with technology and cell phones, it's one of those things, it gets lost. That art of talking is lost.
And the art of becoming family. I mean, I see it with my own kids. I mean, they're older now. My kids are in their 30s, but I used to see it where we would be at their uncle's house and they'd be sitting on the phones texting each other on the phones because they didn't want to say what they wanted, they didn't want to talk out loud. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. You have to learn how to communicate with people. And it's so important. You have to be able to walk up to someone, shake their hand, look them in the eye, and communicate with them.
Definitely. Yes, sir. Okay. With that being said, What does the term aggressive mean to you?
Aggressive means doing your job, getting in there and doing it. Okay. The fire does not go out if we don't go in and put it out. Now, aggressive means you are safe, but you are going in and doing your job. If you are going to stand out in the yard the entire time and not go into the building, there's something wrong. You shouldn't be in the fire service. Now, I don't want you charging in there without having a size up, a complete understanding of what's going on, knowing what your resources are. I come from New York City. We have a hydrant every 600 feet. Water, usually, depending on the time of year, is not a major problem. I mean, in the middle of the summer, when it's 90 degrees out, you can have a low water alert because of all of the open hydrants for the kids in the neighborhoods, setting up sprinklers and everything else. During the middle of winter, you can have frozen hydrants. Okay, you have to understand these things. But every department, every organization has its own unique plan for it to do its job. And you can't be New York City. But I can't be Ottumwa, Iowa either, because it's a different thing. So you have to understand your organization, your limits, and what you can do with the people you have. New York City, I joke, is like the Chinese army. People just keep coming over the hill. Okay. We have more people working. I mean, if you look at an all hands fire, you probably have 70 something people show up at the fire. Okay. Some departments, that's their entire daily manning. Other departments, that's their entire department. So, I have friends who have responded in a truck company with one person. Well, that's so foreign to me that you're the only person on a truck company. You don't even have anybody sitting in the right-hand seat to look out the window to see if you're going to hit something. They're not there. So you have to learn how to deal with it that way. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I would love to get everybody more manning, but I can't do that. But understanding what you have and where you come from and putting that into play makes you better. And being aggressive with that, understanding the risks. I have friends who are up in Alaska. The next closest department is, 25, 30 minutes away. Well, there's a difference. You're not getting a RIT team the way you and I expect the RIT team to come be there in the first 5 minutes of the fire. It's not happening. So being aggressive means you're willing to go in there and do your job. But aggressive has to be tempered with personal knowledge and safety, that you understand that you are keeping your people safe. Okay. And listen, I've heard this said hundreds of times, giving it a quick knock from the outside, oh my God, you're going to kill everybody inside. We've been doing that for years. Okay. We've been doing that. We used to pull up the commercials, hit it with the deck gun real quick, knock it down, cool it down before we have to go in there and get burnt up. That's still being aggressive. You're going in to do the job. You just have to know what you're doing, when you're doing it, and everything else. And being aggressive means that you know how to do your job and are willing to go in there. Okay. But it's not being stupid. It's not being reckless. It's not being not looking at all of the things that the building is telling you, that the situation is telling you. And I think it's important that we are aggressive, but we are smart.
Definitely. Okay. All right. When it came to your career, how long and at what point did you decide to start moving up the ranks?
I decided when I became a fireman, I wanted to study. And I didn't start studying for a couple of years. And then in New York City, they have a lieutenant's test every 4 years, usually. Sometimes it's longer. Sometimes if they promote everybody, it's less, but usually it's every 4 years. So you have to get on the list. And I studied, excuse me, for lieutenant. And we had a study group, and I studied with a bunch of guys. And it was fun. My wife used to call them the nerds. The nerds are showing up. And we went to somebody different, somebody's house different every week. And we would meet once a week, and we would go over and we'd do assignments. And I had we had index cards with all these questions. We must have had thousands and thousands of index cards with all these questions. The New York City Fire Department books, they took a picture a long time ago with the chief of training, Jack Mooney, standing there with his elbow on all the books. Now, they were put in binders, so they're in binders, but what you have to study for lieutenant was an incredible amount of our rules and regulations. And I decided I was going to study, and I studied hard. And I got made promoted to lieutenant in January of 94. So I had 8.5 years on the job when I got promoted to lieutenant. And it was great. I loved being a lieutenant. I bounced around the city. We have to, you can't stay in the area that you worked. You have to go to another borough. So I ended up getting, I got kind of a little bit of trouble. My mustache used to be red, and I got a an award. I got the Daily News Hero of the Month, and my rescue. I made a rope rescue off the roof of a building in 91, December 23rd of 91. I went off the roof of a building, and in the back it was 7 stories, in the front it was 6 stories. But I went off the roof of the building, grabbed the guy, and went down past the fire. And when I showed up for the Daily News Hero of the Month, I had my red mustache, and it was kind of like it is now. And they said that my mustache made U-turns on my face, and I was an embarrassment to the department because I didn't conform to the grooming standards. And I was ordered to shave my mustache. So I did. And then nobody else was ordered to shave, so I grew my mustache back. And then I ended up at the bombing of the World Trade Center, the first bombing in 93, and I ended up on Nightline and everything else. And I got yelled at for my mustache again. And I got in trouble again. So when I got promoted, I got sent to a place that was not as desirable as I wanted. So I had to do about 1.5 years in that area, pay my penance. And then I got out. I ended up going back up to Harlem.
Okay. Was there any particular reason why you decided to promote?
Well, two reasons. Money is always one. I used to, one of my mentors used to tell me to study with a $100 bill in front of you. And this was in the 80s and early 90s. And he said, the lieutenant is making $100 more a tour than you are for being here as a lieutenant. Think about that. And then he said, when you become a lieutenant, the captain who's working in the company next to you is making $100 more a tour than you are being a captain. So study. So I studied, and I studied for lieutenant and captain, and I did pretty well on both of the tests, and I got promoted. And then I was going to study for battalion chief, and I was studying for battalion chief. And my wife's mom was very sick and was dying. And at one point, I'm leaving my little kids to go to study group, and my wife is at the hospital, and my kids got a babysitter, and they're crying. And I'm like, I can't do this to my kids. So I went to study group, and I said to the guys, I can't do this, guys. I can't do this to my family. I got to be there for my wife and my kids. And it's one of the things that I preach to everyone in the fire service. Because sooner or later, your career is going to be over. And what you built at home is going to be your support service. And if you do not protect that, it is going to come back to haunt you. I mean, I'm going away with my wife in a couple of weeks. We're going to celebrate our 39th wedding anniversary. She still likes me. I don't know why, but she still likes me. But, you know, we've been together 45 years. You know, that's a lifetime in itself. But it's just so amazing. But there were brothers and sisters who will give up their family for the fire service. And it is so, so, so important that you keep the people you love in your mind. I love the brothers and sisters. I love the firehouse. I like to say, listen, I don't miss the circus. I miss the clowns. I miss the brothers and sisters. My favorite place in the entire fire service was on the rig after a job. When the brothers and sisters are all like, where'd you go? You had the irons. How was the door to force? You had the OV, the outside vent. How did you get into the apartment from there? Did you go through the rear yard? Did you go under? Did you go through? What did you do? How did you get there? I love that point after a fire where everyone is so like, what did we do? What went well? What could we have done better? It is so important. And I think it's so, so cool that we do that, that we communicate after the fire, that we sit down. Now we got to go back. We got to take our showers and everything else. But then I think we have to sit in the kitchen and discuss what we did, what went right, what went wrong, what did we learn? And is there anything that surprised us? And I think it's important that we do that as a fire service.
Definitely, definitely, like we talked about earlier, in some organizations, it's definitely a lost art for sure. Because some will, as soon as they get back, it's everybody's hitting their own thing.
And they're going to their own little bunk room, their own little, and, you know, all right, take a shower and have a drill. And I think you should also be empowered to have the drills. I remember one of the things that always comes back that I always talk about too is we went to a job one night and I'm back in the office and I'm just doing a little bit of the paperwork and my senior man comes in and he says, hey Cap, we're having a drill in the kitchen. I said, okay, I'll be in a minute. He goes, you're not invited. I said, okay. He said, go upstairs and take a shower. And he was the senior firefighter, the senior man. Something happened at the job that I didn't see, that I was not, and he was not going to embarrass anybody. He was not going to do it in front of me. And that is when you know you have a great company, a great support system, where something is going to get fixed, but nobody's going to get hurt. Nobody's going to get embarrassed. Nobody's going to get shamed or anything else. And I think that's one of the things that we have to look at too in the fire service, is getting our people to understand that making a mistake at a fire is normal. If I had a dollar for every mistake I made at a fire, I'd have my own Caribbean island. Okay. And that's just the way it is. But not making the same mistake the second time is what makes us good firefighters.
For sure. Sure. You mentioned that after you were quote unquote paroled, you went back to, you know, the borough that you loved. So if I can ask, what then sparked you to move up to captain? And how long did you wait in between between lieutenant and captain?
I was promoted to lieutenant in 1994, January 23rd, 1994, and I was promoted to captain July 1st of 2000. So the test was coming, and I took the test, and I thought I was going to study for chief and become a chief, but that wasn't meant to be. because my mother-in-law, as I said, got sick. And then they changed the rules. And to be a battalion chief for the next chief, you needed a college degree. And I'm getting near the point where I'm paying for my kids are, I'm working. My wife did not work. And that was the deal we made. I told her she could stay home and raise the kids, but she could never complain about me working. And I worked three jobs. And she was like, "That's fine. I want to be home with my kids." And I said, "Okay, that's fine. And you can never say anything about me leaving to work. You have to, we, this is a deal we are making together." And she said, "That's fine." So we did that. She didn't go back to work until my youngest was in middle school. And said in middle school, had done a year in middle school. And then my wife took a job and went back to work for a couple of, for, a while for the local government. But the money was the big between lieutenant captain. But the other thing about it is a lieutenant in a firehouse. And I don't know if your organization has lieutenants and captains. In New York City, we have a captain. Every company has the captain. And then they have three lieutenants. And then you have your firefighters. A lieutenant, if I'm a lieutenant and I say you can't do this, it means you can't do it when I'm working. And whatever your Ten Commandments are, everyone has their own things that they are passionate about. Are you passionate about the uniform? Are you passionate about the rules and the regulations? Are you passionate about the driving? Whatever it is, however you want to do this, you cannot on a lieutenant, you can't do this when I'm working. I'm not going to allow it. As a captain, you can't do this in my firehouse. You can control more as a captain because you can say, not in my company. We are not doing this. And I think you make a bigger impact as a captain. And that's one of the other reasons I studied. I think you can have more of an impact. But the other thing is, being a captain and a lieutenant, you are training your replacements. You are training the men and women who are going to make the fire department better. Some of the kids I had as young men and probies, one of them's going to be the chief of the department, I think. He's just such a smart young man. And he's a deputy chief now, and I think he's going to be chief of department. And good for him. Going to be a great guy. But it's all part of it. You, as an officer, can impact the organization. And if you do the job right and you teach your men and women how to do the job right, now as they branch out into the fire department, they are doing it right in Fire Station 1, in Fire Station 2, in Firehouse 3, Firehouse 4, wherever it is, they are doing it. And your impact can be felt throughout the organization. I look at some of the stuff, some of the people who worked for me, where they are and what's going on. And it's great to see, because you make an impact on your organization. Doesn't matter how big or small it is. If you train people right, they make an impact. If they change shifts, even if they go to another department or move someplace else, you make an impact. And that training is so much a vital part of that.
And one thing that I love that you mentioned was the fact that as company officers, you said that you're training your replacement. And it's my personal opinion. I think certain company officers now who aren't doing what they need to do are losing sight of that exact fact because their subordinates are seeing how they view the job. And so in return, they could be like, oh, well, my captain used to do this, even though it might not be right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're more worried about your part-time gig, whether it's you're an accountant and a tax guy and it's tax season, whether you're a house painter and you're worried about painting, you take your drill time in the firehouse and you're cleaning paint brushes and you're not doing whatever it is, whatever it is. If you are not doing the right thing by your company and your men and women, there is something wrong. If you are not training them, you are not drilling them. And very honestly, drilling is an art form. Drilling is so important. But if I sit there and pick up a piece of paper and I read it to you, I read you a book, and now you get to the window and you are going to take your tool and you are going to break the glass. And when you break the glass, you're going to make sure that you stay away from the glass shards. And if I sit there and read it to you, it's like I don't care how involved, how energetic you are, I'm going to put you right to sleep. It's like a slow drip of Somnex. I mean, it is, and they're the people who are the monotone. You want to have a drill? Go take a picture from a magazine. Take a copy of Fire Engineering, Firehouse, any magazine. Pick a picture. Okay, what about this? What do you see here? Let's go over this. Let's talk about if we pull up to this right now, what are we going to do? Where are we going to put the first line? Where's the ladder going to go? Where's the truck going to position? How's the engine going to position? Are we going to leave room for the truck? Do we have wires? Are we going to be able to use the tower ladder, the basket? Are we going to be able to, what's going on here? What do you see? And it's so simple to do, especially now with the internet. You can look up stuff. You can look up line of duty reports. What happened? There is so much information out there. And just to partake from mistakes of the past. Impart that knowledge, that wisdom to your men and women. What we've done wrong. Listen, there are a ton of stuff we have done wrong. Okay? Guilty. Guilty as charged. Seatbelts? Not until I became a captain did I wear a seatbelt. Until a guy I knew was in an accident and almost killed. And if he hadn't had his seatbelt on, and he said, I don't know why I put my seatbelt on that day, but he would have been ejected through the front of the rig and he would have died. Okay? We didn't wear seatbelts. We didn't wear masks. Okay? I got yelled at for bringing an SCBA to an oil burner fire. Like, kid, we don't bring those to these. And what's an oil burner smoke now? Some of the worst crap you can breathe in and it sticks in your lungs. So no, it's definitely something that we have to think about, how we're going to teach our people. And we make mistakes, and that's okay. I mean, listen, I was lucky enough in the beginning of my career, back in the day, when I was a volunteer, we used to ride the back step. And then for a little while I was in the city and we were riding in the telephone booth on the spare rigs, and it was the greatest place in the world to be. But it's not smart.
Right. Okay. Have you always loved ladder work, or is that something that, did you do some time in an engine and then you're like, hey, I want to try this, or was it something you knew from the moment you got on the FDNY?
Well, when I got on the FDNY, I was assigned to a ladder company. And when I was transferred, I was assigned to a ladder company. I liked ladder work. Engine work is great. I've worked in some great engine companies. My captain, they call it an R group in New York City, my captain's relief group in Brooklyn was amazing. It was the engine companies were 290, 234. And then three ladder companies, 175, 132, and 113. And I got to see all of these companies do their jobs. And I got to go to some great fires with the engine companies, had some fun with the engine companies, and had a good time. I liked ladder work. I liked truck work. I like the idea that you are thinking, okay? And it doesn't say the engine company's not thinking, and I don't mean it like that at all. It's that you have to have an idea in your head how you are going to do this, where you're going to get to, and everything else. And, with the truck company, I think you have the ability to make more of an impact on the members, because you have to get them thinking. They have to be thinking, okay? And I mean, listen, there are some great engine men. I have friends who have been engine men their entire careers, and they were good engine men. So I think there's nothing wrong with that. I just liked the ladder work. I mean, when I was a young fireman, there was nothing better than being what we called the OV, the outside vent. And the outside vent and getting into the apartment before they got in through the front door and get there and unlock the front door for them as they're coming up. There was nothing better than that. And, you know, those are the fun things. But I enjoyed the heck out of truck work.
Okay. No, you don't have to say any more. I wanted to ask you. Wanted to
No.
ask.
No.
Okay. In your opinion, what does leadership look like, whether it's company officer or chief officer?
Doing the right thing, even when nobody's watching. Doing what's right for your organization, not for yourself, for your team and your organization. Doing what is right. Okay. I think one of the biggest problems we have in the fire service is that people are trying to make it into a model of a business plan. They're trying to make it into a business. We are not in a business. We are in a calling, a vocation, okay? And we should be advocates for that vocation, for that calling, that the men and women we want are the people who want to make an impact. They want to do the right thing. They want to protect the public, and they want to get better at protecting the public. And if you're more worried about you, your career, your standing in the organization than you are about the men and women that work with you or for you, you have a misplaced priorities. So I think leadership looks like the person that's doing the right thing. And, you know, it's easy to do. You know, you keep your word. You say what you're going to do. And if you can't keep your word, you admit, okay, I said I was going to do this and I can't do it. I can't make it happen. And, you know, that's what it's going to be. I remember as a captain, New York City was coming out with chemical protective clothing, CPC units, going to be part of the DECON task force. So I went and I lobbied for my company to become a CPC truck company. And in the end, they only, the CPCs went to, most of them went to tower ladders because they want the tower ladder to be able to mass decon. Okay, that's fine. But my guy said to me, "Hey, Cap, why are you doing this?" I said, "Well, I got a couple of reasons." "Okay, can you tell us?" "Sure. First off, if we get the clothing in the firehouse, God forbid something happens, the men and women working on this tour in my company will be protected because we have the CPC unit. Secondly, you're going to make a little extra money. You're going to have to get trained on this, and there's going to have to be refresher training, and it's going to be a little built-in overtime for you guys. But more importantly than that is that you are going to be protected if something happens." And I couldn't make it work because they wanted it to be in tower ladders. I tried, but couldn't make it work. So I told them, okay, not going to happen. It's going to be in tower ladders. But it, again, it's just something that, you know, you want what's right for the company, for the people, is what you want.
Okay. Personal question I want to ask you. Is there a difference in functions between tower ladders and straight ladders, or is it just one is a straight stick, the other one has a bucket?
No, there's different in functions. There's difference in functions. In a tower ladder, the chauffeur is always supposed to be at the pedestal. Okay. Supposed to be there to be able to move the tower ladder.
Okay.
At a straight stick, the chauffeur can go up on the roof once he puts the ladder up and all that. So there are different positions by your assigned position in that company where you go. And so tower ladders differ from rear mounts, but they definitely have different procedures. The OV is in the bucket. In a rear mount, the OV usually is responsible to get around the back of the building, take a look, but he's going to go opposite the fire. but he wants to see what's going on. If there's anybody out, the OV is going to be running around the building and making, looking at different things. So again, it depends on, and this is a big thing in New York City, it depends on the building type. And that's one of the things that New York City does as well as any other department in the world. We differentiate our buildings. Is it a row frame, rows of buildings attached to each other? Is it a brownstone? Is it a multiple dwelling? Is it a fireproof multiple dwelling? Is it an old law tenement? Is it a new law tenement? What's going on? We even differentiate between row frames, which are attached row homes. A row frame, if there are three windows in the front or four. If there are four windows in the front, it means they can have apartments on either side of the hallway. If there are three, it means that the apartment is on that floor. Okay? So it kind of differs. So you have to understand your buildings. And that's one of the things that we train our people in all the time. You know, look at the buildings, see what it is, know what you're going to, what type of building this is by when you respond there.
Okay. Good thing I asked. I was just curious that, between if there was a difference, and you would definitely explain that. Okay. I'm not sure if you have any family members, friends that are in that are going into the fire service or are into the fire service now, but in your opinion, what can we do better? When I mean we, I mean the fire service can do better when it comes to recruitment and retention.
We have to make it fun. Okay. Now, listen, a lot of people, hazing and things like that, they're very anti-hazing. I don't think there's a problem with making it fun. If I get hit with a bucket of water, I got hit with a bucket of water a couple of times. As the captain, they doused me. Okay, not a big deal. I remember going into the kitchen one day and sitting down in my favorite easy chair, and all of a sudden my butt was soaking wet. They had soaked the cushion. It was hysterical. They got me. Okay. I think we have to make it fun, but we also have to make it, I don't know what the right words, we have to get young men and women into it by either visiting schools or going to places to find people who want to do the job. Military members are great. Lifeguards are great. Finding people who want to do the job and explaining to them what's going on. Men and women out there doing the job, just explaining to it how it is and answering questions for kids. I mean, I have a couple of my nephew is in Rescue One in New York City now. My niece's husband is in Squad 61 up in the North Bronx. And then my other niece's husband is a fireman down in Volusia County. So they're all doing the job to recruitment and retention. If you're not retaining your people, there are a lot of things in retention that are different to me than recruitment. Retention is money. Can I afford to buy a house in the area that I serve in? Can I afford to live there? I've been in places where the guys drive 3 or 4 hours to get to work because they can't afford to live where they work. I know a lot of California is going through that now, that they can't get people because the cost of living is so high. So you have to figure out how you're going to make this work for these people, what you're going to do to make it easier for them. And that's how you retain them. Okay. Recruiting is just getting people in the door to see what's going on and enjoying the whole gambit of what we do. I mean, I think most people know at their first working fire whether they're going to do this forever or not. I mean, either you're hooked or you're not. And most people who are into the job are hooked at day one. And they're like, this is the greatest thing in the world.
Definitely, definitely. And occasionally we do have some that slip, and that's everywhere, that slip through the cracks.
Yes. And very honestly, I've talked to a couple of people who are big in this, the recruitment and retention. And one of the things they're going is they're going back to the people who they think were good and who slipped through the cracks and going to try to bring them back. Now, occasionally we get somebody going the other way who maybe shouldn't be here and they kind of slip through the cracks and they're here. And maybe we have to bring them up and get them into the fold, so to speak. But again, it depends on the individual. It depends on the individual.
What's your take on outside training? Getting outside of your own organization and learning something new to try to maybe bring in?
I think it's great because there were different things that are done all over the country. And you learn different things that people do, and sometimes never going to work for you. But other times you're going to be like, damn, that's a good idea. I mean, going back to the engine companies, hose folds, how we're stretching it, how we're packing the hose line. There are 8,000 different ways to do this. Which one is working the best for departments that mimic you? Which one is working the best? Why? What's being done? Why aren't we doing it that way? Did this work? Did it not work? Why didn't it work? So many different things. What tools go on the tip of the ladder? What goes in the bucket? All of this stuff is part of learning. And other people might be doing it a little different than you. And that's great because it's another tool in the toolbox. And outside training is a huge part of that. Okay. And if you are not empowering your men and women to learn, shame on you as someone in charge, as a chief officer or somebody else. I mean, I think very honestly, I've seen people throw up roadblocks for outside training. You can't bring your gear. It's our gear. You can't bring your gear. You can't wear your helmet. You can't, well, you're throwing up the person who wants to make your organization better. You're putting a roadblock, an impediment in their way. Okay, let them go learn what somebody else is doing to see if it works, to see if they can bring it back. Now, what I would say is if you're going to outside training, Danny, you're going to outside training, where are you going? I'm going to the HROC conference. Okay, here you go. Go do what you got to do. When you come back, I would like you to just give me an outline of what you learned. So come either talk to me or talk to the department and spread the word of what the training is, especially if the department's paying for it. You spread the word as to what you learned and how it's going to benefit our department. And give a report, give it a talk, whatever it is. Film a short, 5 minute what we learned.
That's for sure. Okay. I love it. Love it. All right. Next topic of wellness and truly being there. It's for sure everybody should know the history of the FDNY and, the various calls in nature that you guys respond to, but I don't think there'll be really another department that will ever go, hopefully not, knock on wood, that would ever go through what you guys did on September 11th. But with that being said, I'm sure the brotherhood and the wellness for the FDNY was amazingly strong, getting yourselves through that, correct?
Correct. Correct. The Brotherhood was extremely important, but so was counseling. Now, I talk about this all the time. I even do a class on it. Tough guys sometimes need help. I consider myself a pretty decent fireman. Not great, but okay. But I took the hardest punch I ever took in my life from a 6-year-old girl, my daughter. after 9/11, when she looked at me and said, "Daddy, why are you always angry?" And that buckled my knees. It buckled me. And I looked at my wife and she said, "Honey, the kids are afraid of you." And I'm like, "What? What?" And I was drinking way too much and I was angry and I was mad and I had to go get help. And I said to my wife, "Okay, I'm going to go get help." She said, "Thank you, Jesus, you know." And I went and I got help. Now, I will tell this to everybody. I went through three therapists, three. The first one was a young girl. She was 20-something years old. She was my niece's age. And I looked at her, and I'm in my 50s, and I'm like, "I'm sorry. I think you're probably great, but I don't think I can talk to you." And she goes, "I do understand that. I do understand that. I'll get you another one." She got me a second person, and I went to the second person, and she was an older female, but she had a voice that was squeaky, and it went like fingernails on a chalkboard. It went right through me. And I said, "This is not going to work." And so the third person they got me was a retired police officer who had walked the same streets I had walked. We had been in the same neighborhoods at different times, and we hit it off. My wife used to call him my boyfriend. And she'd every once in a while, she'd look at me and go, "You're getting a little testy. When are you going to see your boyfriend?" I said, "Oh, I got an appointment with him this week." "Oh, good, 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 excellent." And I went through therapy, I went through counseling, and I got help. And it probably saved my marriage. It saved my marriage. It probably saved my life and saved my family. And if there's anybody out there who thinks that counseling and taking care of your own mental health is a bad thing, please give me a call because I will talk to you. I will set you straight. Listen. We can all sometimes need help. And there is nothing wrong with needing help. And admitting that you're not dealing with this properly, you're not framing it, processing it, you're not dealing with it properly. And if you're taking it out on the people you love, that's really sad.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think there's two key factors for me that resound with what you stated, the mental health and getting yourself in check, because you know the fire service has a bravado, we're macho, we don't need help, we provide the help, but sometimes we do need that help. And secondly, to me, which for me really is number one, is the fact that you said you got to make sure that your house, meaning your household, your home, is in order first. Because it's so easy with the fire service. We want to, like for me, I want to go to this class. I want to go to this conference. And if I go, that's time away on top of when I'm already at work that I'm not home. And I can lose sight of what's important because I want to be good. And I'm not saying us firemen, we want to be good at the job, that we should be. But there's a cost and we have to find that balance, which sometimes is very hard to do.
Very hard to do. Very hard to do. One of my recommendations that I always tell everyone that I think is important, date your wife. When I used to get like an overtime shift and I got money, I would go to the bank and, you know, part of it would definitely go to the bills, but I would take $100 cash out of the bank and I'd give it to my wife. And I would say, you know, "Honey, here you go. This is a $100. When you want to go out, give me the date. You and I will go out. We'll go out and have dinner. We'll get a sitter, leave the kids home." We had another couple had kids about the same age as ours, and we used to swap off, you know, say, because then you didn't have to pay for a babysitter. So you could go to a nicer dinner, you know, and be like, "Hey, you know, we're thinking about going out Tuesday night. Are you guys around?" "Yeah. Yeah, can you watch the kids?" "Yeah, yeah." And then, you know, they lived right around the corner. And they'd watch the kids. We'd come back and get them. We'd go out to dinner. And then a week later, they'd say, "Hey, we're going out to dinner." "Okay, bring the kids down, drop them off. We're here." You know, and unfortunately, sometimes because of working, it fell on my wife to be the babysitter. But when you have kids together and they're the same age, it's not a big deal.
Right.
So, but that's all that support network that's behind you. That's all that stuff that's behind you. And that's what you have to do.
For sure. Okay. My last question I like to always ask the guests, but I always like to ask the guests, where would you like to see yourself before you retire? But you have already retired. So I'm going to kind of change it up to what's retirement like? So what do I have to look forward to getting to the position that you're in?
Well, first off, you have to be prepared for retirement. Now, I retired from the FDNY medically because I had to get a new knee.
Okay.
So I got a new knee out of the deal, but I wasn't ready to be retired yet. So I went to work in New York City in a group called, it was called, the New York Fire Safety Institute. And what it was just a group that trained with fire safety directors and was in buildings. And my specialty was going to buildings after fires and educating the staff and the tenants as to how to operate in there. So I spent about 10 and a half years doing that. I started it before I even retired. And they just said, you want to do this? Sure, I can teach. I like to teach. So, and then I did it. I continued doing it after I retired. So there are a couple of things. First off, you have to have some kind of a hobby, some kind of a support system to retire. If you are, unfortunately, you're divorced because you didn't take care of that family, or you don't have significant people in your life, it's very lonely. So I have my wife, I have my daughters, I have my friends all around. I go out and get coffee with my, we call it Romeo, retired old men eating out. 3 times a week, I meet the guys for coffee and we discuss the world's problems. It's kind of like going to the firehouse kitchen for, so I have that. I always put money away. I grew up wealthy for a while. My father came back from World War II and worked for the American Tobacco Company. And until 69, was doing very well because they were advertising cigarettes on TV. So he was traveling around the country and meeting people. I mean, I got to meet Joe Namath as a kid because he was doing an ad for one of the cigarette manufacturers. And then that Congress passed the act. It wasn't allowed to be on TV. And we went from being pretty well to do, belonging to the country club, to we couldn't do that anymore. And it was a whole different ball game. So I always prepared myself. When I retired, I was deferring 23% of my salary was going into different retirement functions. Okay. Every time I got a raise, if I got a 2% raise, 1% went to my retirement because I'd never miss it. 1% went to me. So it was the 401k, the 457, whatever your retirement is, I was in that. I also worked other part-time jobs. If there was a retirement thing issue offered there, I joined it. I worked for the state part-time and I took all that money at the state and I put that in and I rolled that into my retirement and I did all of those things. So I planned my retirement. My wife and I are never going to eat dog food. Okay. I mean, we are going to try to spend my kids' inheritance, but it's not going to be possible, I don't think. But I always, always, always planned. Now, in saying this, I'm going to say one more thing, especially for our brothers and sisters who are out there who have had marital issues or whatever else, divorced or whatever else. Make sure your house is in order as far as money. Who gets what? If God forbid something happens to you. I had a friend across the street, unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. He was down in Florida looking for a piece of property with his wife, had a heart attack, and on the side of the highway, she's doing CPR on him, and he didn't make it. And the stuff that wives don't know.
Mm.
It flabbergasted, it floored my wife. Like how to turn on and off the outside spigots during the winter because of the freezing weather. How to cover the air conditioner. What credit cards I have in my wallet. What the passwords are for all of the things. How to pay the bills. I've always paid the bills. My wife had no idea. And my wife went out and got a book. It's called I'm Dead, Now What? And it sounds morbid, but it's amazing. It's got all my life insurance in there, who to contact in the union when something happens to me, what my pension is, what my Social Security is, every credit card that's in my wallet. There's a copy of it in there with the password, the username, the ID. It's all locked in a file in our safe that my wife has. You have to be prepared. And very honestly, it's difficult to do, but I have seen guys who got killed in the line of duty and they're remarried and they never changed anything with the job and their ex-wife gets everything. So even for retirement, you have to be prepared. You have to know what you're going to do. And you have to have some kind of hobby, some kind of friendship, some kind of things that you're going to do to make it better.
Sure. Solid advice. Solid advice. Kath, I appreciate you coming on and talking shop. I appreciate you accepting the invite. I love hearing the stories. I don't care if you're active in the fire service, retired or not, I think we all have something we can bring to the table, especially when it comes from individuals who are into the job, such as yourself.
Well,
So
thank you.
I want to say thank you very much for coming on. I really enjoyed talking to you.
No problem. I appreciate it, brother. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.